than before, but it's Ross Bagel. Because it's Spaniard and all of them big with him the way you hear, you know. I him create them, so Rafi give him the honor and respect. Ross Bagel. Lord,
bless the far
eye.
Bless up, Ross Bagel. Because the man make the rhythm. The rhythm there, I say, they're good. You see it? I tell you, Montreal. Ross Bagel, you make a nice rhythm, rhythm, rhythm.
The tune tough, the tune rhythm, tough. Rhythm, big nice. Up Ross Bagel, Jakarta. It's on CTV, y'all.
Keep the skill, my brother. Enough respect to the man, let me see it. Keep do the work, don't feel yourself. Just keep your head above the water. Keep on telling, do the 95 work and just come and do your thing. Because Roger Moore can sing and sing. Jiggy, jiggy. I think after hours, give me a little brata. Montreal!
I'll be home in Montreal. Where the summers never fall.
Yeah, yeah, yes, when you fly out, I fly out, we are flying. When you're flying, that's what I say, you know. I'll be home in Montreal. That's where we belong, you see. They must think of Jamaica alone, we can't go, hey, and stay.
Hey, Cutter.
Come back, you know,
Cutter,
see.
Cutter. Fire to you, I got a TD bank, go draw some money. Me want that tune upon. Dub!
You can call from California.
United States. Hey, bro, now listen to what I'm going to say. We're gonna sing together, right? Are you ready?
I'll be home in my. Where the summers never fall. Whoa, whoa, now. December's on the way.
Montreal, that's how we live, that's how we live, that's how we live. I'm gonna play some tune until till after hours come right in and take over.
You say again and again, you know just how to soothe me, baby, and ease my mind.
Your easy squeeze make no riot, you see. If you're on the road, just easy squeeze. Just listen to the reggae vibe on Positive Vibe on CKUT 9.3 FM. Hey,
you're one of a kind. Ooh, baby, you're one of a kind.
never knew what love was about until I met your girl and I held you in my arms.
That's a reaching out to all my ladies, yo.
You're a part of my world.
I'm gonna leave it with this run right now. Cause enough love in my heart for each and every one. I see it. Enough respect to each and every one who call in. I will take in a vibe and pass the vibe on CKUT 90.3 FM.
And treat you right. I wanna love you every day and every night. We'll be together with the roof.
There is this thing going on.
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news have brought to you live.
Listening to the Prison Radio Show, a part of CKUT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air for more than 10 years. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about what are prisons and the people inside our jails. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties with incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation and that our understanding of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in collaborating on programming to contact us. Those who have been affected by the prison system in any way are encouraged to get involved. You can email news@cqt.ca or prison@cqt.ca, or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You're listening to CQUT, Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial and www.cqut.ca online.
You are listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CQUT. My name is Candace.
And my name is Noah.
And we're your hosts for today's show.
In honor of Mother's Day, Prison Radio spoke with Rebecca Flores in San Antonio, Texas, about the 78 mothers who staged two work and hunger strikes at the Karnes County Detention Center near the Mexico-U.S. border last month. We'll also be airing an interview with Mika Kanjani. We will be discussing her film Free World Pens, which we aired excerpts from on our last show. We will also be airing excerpts from the essay Sister Soldiers, read by the essay's author, Tasha Fierce, about Black women and police violence. First up, we have a couple of news items for you. A prisoner is working with organizers in Australia to avoid being forcibly medicated. According to Justice Action in Australia, prisoner Malcolm Baker has served 23 years with 15 years in effective solitary confinement. On April 30th, the Mental Health Review Tribunal in Australia was deciding whether or not to order the forced medication of Malcolm Baker, who was accused of needing medication because he, quote, regularly sends drawings and ideas for inventions to Senator Clive Palmer, unquote. According to Justice Action's Twitter account, Malcolm won his case at the Mental Health Review Tribunal. Lawyers from the Abolitionist Law Center and the Amistad Law Project have won their fight to shut down Bill SB 508 in Pennsylvania. The bill, otherwise known as the Silence Mumia Act, was put in place to stop prisoners from speaking publicly on the radio. A press release from prisonradio.org notes, quote, "It's hard to rejoice in this victory when Mumia is under medical neglect. Riot police are terrorizing Baltimore, and the state violence that killed Freddie Gray and is putting Mumia's life on the line is not unique, but ingrained in the U.S.'s racist system of policing, surveillance, and imprisonment. But we want to take this moment with you to recognize this enormous win, which shut down the Fraternal Order of Police in their tracks and will keep Mumia and all prisoners able to speak to the public." PrisonRadio.org is calling on supporters to contribute to Mumia's medical fund and to call the Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections, Governor Tom Wolf, and the prison where Mumia is currently imprisoned, SCI Mahonoy, to demand that he be given medical attention. You can find the phone number to call on their website at PrisonRadio.org. After 13 years in prison, Omar Khadr has been released on bail. The decision to grant him bail was made by the Alberta Court of Appeal by Justice Myra Bielby, who refuted the Harper government's attempt to keep Khadr in prison. The time is presently 5:05. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
My name is Sonia Elizabeth Hernandez Amaya. I'm 33 years old. I'm Salvadoran. I'm the mother of Jocelyn, who is 10 years old, Valentin, who is 9 years old, and Moises, who is 3 years old. We were detained on August 1st, 2014. We were 5 days in La Hielera, terribly cold, sleeping on the floor of cold cement. We would cover ourselves with aluminium paper. The federales would count us every 2 or 3 hours. They would get us up and sleeping children to go outside. And they would strike the door hard with their clubs, and they would discriminate against us. They would say that we were dirty, that we had no reason to come here to this country. I feel frustrated, desperate, worried, because why so much time? And now migration won't let us out. My children don't eat because the food is terrible. The water, when we drink, make our stomachs hurt and we got bloated. I don't know what is happening. I want to leave this place.
Last month, we heard about 78 mothers at the Karnes County Residential Center near San Antonio, Texas, who signed a letter demanding their release. The letter, which was originally written in Spanish, announced a work strike at the jail. They said, "During this time, no mother will work in the detention center, nor will we send our children to school, nor will we use any services here until we are heard and approved. We want our freedom." Prison Radio spoke with Rebecca Flores, an organizer with End Family Detention in San Antonio, Texas. She has been regularly visiting the Karnes County Residential Center, where the 78 mothers are being detained. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us here on the program on Prison Radio on CQUT today. Who are you and why are you here?
Well, my name is Rebecca Flores, and I live in San Antonio, Texas. And the refugee camps that are keeping these mothers and their children are 60 miles south of where I live, in Karnes City and in Dilley. Very small little agricultural towns that have been overtaken by these for-profit prisons that are keeping these mothers and their children.
Maybe you could give us a brief update as to what's happening with the 78 mothers who had initially launched a work strike last month at the Karnes Residential Center.
Well, what actually caused them to take matters into their own hands, because that was, I think that was their first protest, first demonstration. These mothers and their children first started coming across into the United States from Central America last summer of 2014, and initially, right away, they got taken into some 3-day prisons there on the Mexican border, and then they got sent into Karnes City. And Billy has just opened in December, but they got sent to Karnes City and another place called Artesia in New Mexico. And so they have asked for political asylum because of fear of what is going on in their own country, and because of the persecution that they are suffering in many different ways. And so they can ask for asylum, which they did, which many did. I think many didn't, and they got deported. But the ones that we're dealing with did, in fact, ask for asylum, and therefore are being kept in these prisons until they can get to an asylum, to their asylum hearing. But what's happened is that in June of last year, because of the politics in this country, there was a policy made, not a law passed, but a policy made by the Department of Homeland Security, which is an executive agency, that executive meaning that it's the President Obama's agency, that they set a policy that said that they were not going to release women, release mothers or their children, if they had a prior deportation. For example, if a woman had come across and then been deported on another occasion, because they keep these files forever, then therefore, if she came across this time in June of last year asking for asylum, that prior deportation was going to have an impact on whether she was let out while she sought asylum before a hearings officer, or kept in the detention centers until she was up for the asylum, and they would have the asylum hearing while she was in the detention center, and then the decision would be made there whether she was free because she proved up her asylum issues or not, and then they would be deported. So what happened is that many of these women couldn't get out. They were classified as having fear of persecution, but they wouldn't be let out. And so they, along with the other mothers, there's a total of 78 mothers, said they had to get this information out to the public at large. And so they went on this hunger strike and this work strike And they kept their children home from school during that period. And that of course, started a week of Easter week and ended on Saturday before Easter. It was a period of about 5 days that they were not eating at all. They were just drinking water.
And my understanding is that the strike ended, but there was a threat to restart the strike.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about the status?
There was a whole lot of retaliation going on while the women were on a hunger strike. Some of them called it a fast because some of them were Catholic, had their Catholic tradition, and it was the week of Easter, and some of them had called it a hunger strike. So either way, they were really pushing to try to get their message out. So because of that, then the ICE, which is the immigration office, threatened the mothers that they would remove their children away. They would take their children away from them, which would mean that they would send their children to foster homes in this country, because if they determined that these women were weakened because they were not eating properly, then therefore were incapable of taking care of their children, and then therefore ICE would have all the right to take them away, to take their children away from them. So that was the first threat, which really scared these women. Many of them were having, pretty heavy, serious thoughts about continuing. The other was that there were five women. They asked everybody who were the leaders, and no one actually said. All the women said, "There are no leaders here. We are all in the same boat, and therefore we're all, asking for ourselves and for all of us." Getting out from this detention center. But ICE determined that there was five leaders, and they put them in isolation. They put them in solitary. And so these solitary rooms were like much like prison rooms. They had the bed, which was bolted to the floor. They had the toilet. They had a table where they would eat. And they would have a lavatory where they could wash their hands. And if you can visualize the prisons, that's really what you see in a prison cell, right? You have the bed bolted down to the ground, you have the toilet, and you have the little table where you eat. And then they turn the lights off during the day. And so the one woman who I have been visiting since January of this year, she has an 11-year-old son. And they fled because of gang violence. So anyway, she and her son were kept in this room, and she was kept the longest. She was let out the last one to be let out. She was kept there a full 24 hours. And her son, who was threatened by gangs in his own country, they killed his best friend in front of him as a way to try to recruit him into the gang. And so he suffered that trauma. And then, when he was kept in this dark room for 24 hours, it has really had an impact and an effect on him. And so, the isolation, the solitary was a real retaliatory move on the by ICE, and also had a major effect. But nevertheless, the women kept on. They got out of solitary because of all of the hullabaloo that was raised in this country and wherever, and then they continued until the Saturday before Easter Sunday with their hunger strike, where they were drinking only water. Now what happened was that also the ICE cleaned out all the refrigerator, because these were refrigerators where they could go and get an apple. The kids could go and get an apple or some milk or whatever. So it was like a freestanding refrigerator where they could go and eat. So they cleaned that out. They wouldn't let anybody have any food. And there was a couple of other incidents of where they were really trying to put more pressure on those women. And so what happened was, after the fifth day, they started eating again. And then they resolved then at that point that if they didn't see anything happening, that in 10 days after that, they would start another hunger strike, which they did. And then that is now over. They did that for about 10 days. They had another hunger strike. And so what's happened, I think, that I've seen, because I've continued to visit, is that they told me that some women did get out. Some women have gotten out seems that quicker. And we don't know whether it's a result of that or whether it's a result of all the other stuff that's been going on in the courts. But nevertheless, it seems to me that some people are being moved quicker than others. Although these women who have had that prior deportation continue to remain in the detention center, in that prison.
Mm-hmm. As you've mentioned, there was a hullabaloo. There were a number of vigils held outside the detention center, including one on April 16th. As one of the organizers of this event, can you tell us a little bit how it went?
Well, you know, we called on, and if you can see this, Carn City is about 60 miles south of here. It's far, okay? So it is an effort to get over there. And so we were able to call on all our friends here in San Antonio. San Antonio is the biggest town closest to it. And so we did, in fact, have a vigil. And as we sat out in front of Carn City in the dark, right, because it was nighttime already, the sheriffs were parked inside the parking lot of their facility, which I think is basically not correct. You know, they're like guarding them when they shouldn't be. Right? It was a peaceful village. We were a bunch of peaceful vigil. It was just all but a group of nuns and a group of, you know, people who understand what to do at vigils, where we pray and where we really lend support to the people inside. But we've had a number of vigils. Yesterday, I don't know if you know this, there was a vigil at Dilley, which is 70 miles south of San Antonio. And there was, I would say there was 1,000 people that congregated there in front of that that detention center where they keep mothers and their children.
Yeah, May 2nd was a National Day of Action to end and family detention. Maybe you could speak to some of the other events that may have took place yesterday, May 2nd.
Well, I don't know of any others. I know there was a number of them, but the one that we were most interested in was the one there in Dilley. We put a lot of effort in making sure that people from all parts of this state of Texas and of other states joined us. One of the speakers is a really, really interesting woman. She, her name is Satsuki Ina, and she was born in a concentration camp in the United States when the Japanese were gathered during as a result of World War II and placed in concentration camps. She was born in, I believe she said, in Crystal City in south of here in Texas, and she and her eating properly. Then, therefore, they were incapable of taking care of their children, and then, therefore, ICE would have all the right to take them away, to take their children away from them. So that was the first threat, which really scared these women. Many of them were having, you know, pretty heavy, serious thoughts about continuing. The other was that there were five women. They asked everybody who were the leaders. And said, all the women said, there are no leaders here. We are all in the same boat, and therefore we're all, you know, asking for ourselves and for all of us getting out from this detention center. But ICE determined that there was five leaders, and they put them in isolation. They put them in solitary. And so these solitary rooms were like much like prison rooms. They had the bed, which was bolted to the floor. They had the toilet. They had a table where they would eat, and they would have a lavatory where they could wash their hands. And if you can visualize the prisons, that's really what you see in a prison cell, right? You have the bed bolted down to the ground. You have the toilet, and you have the little table where you eat. And then they turn the lights off during the day. And so the one woman who I have been visiting since January of this year. She has an 11-year-old son, and they fled because of gang violence. So anyway, she and her son were kept in this room, and she was kept the longest. She was let out the last one to be let out. She was kept there a full 24 hours. And her son, who has who was threatened by gangs in his own country. They killed his best friend in front of him as a way to try to recruit him into the gang. And so he suffered that trauma. And then, when he was kept in this dark room for 24 hours, it has really had an impact and an effect on him. And so, the isolation, the solitary was a real retaliatory move on the by ICE, and also had a major effect. But nevertheless, the women kept on. They got out of solitary because of all of the hullabaloo that was raised in this country and wherever. And then they continued until the Saturday before Easter Sunday with their hunger strike, where they were drinking only water. Now, what happened was that also the ICE cleaned out all the refrigerator, because these were refrigerators where they could go and get an apple. The kids could go and get an apple or some milk or whatever. So it was like a freestanding refrigerator where they could go and eat. So they cleaned that out. They wouldn't let anybody have any food. And there was a couple of other incidents of where they were really trying to put more pressure on those women. And so what happened was, after the fifth day, they started eating again. And then they resolved then at that point that if they didn't see anything happening, that in 10 days after that, they would start another hunger strike, which they did. And then...
Now the wind has changed direction. I think I'll have to leave. Won't you please
That was Aretha Franklin's cover of Elton John's Border Song. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Arrêtons les déportations. Un statut pour tous et toutes.
Stop deportations. Status for all. Sunday, May 31st at 2 p.m. at Metro Saint-Michel. A march for justice and dignity for all migrants and refugees.
Une marche pour la justice et la dignité pour toutes les personnes immigrantes et les réfugiés. Dimanche 31 mai, 14h, au métro Saint-Michel. Pour tous les détails, consultez solidaritésansfrontières.org.
We will march through the neighborhoods of Saint-Michel and Villeray, ending at Park Dairy and Park Extension at 4 p.m. This is a child-friendly event. Bring your kids.
Cette manif est familiale. Amenez vos enfants. Nous marcherons à travers les quartiers Saint-Michel et Villeray et terminerons notre marche au Parc Jarry dans Parc Extension à 16h.
Get in touch about any accessibility needs. For full details, visit solidarityacrossborders.org.
No borders, no nations. Stop the deportations. So. Solidarité. Avec les sans-papiers, avec les réfugiés.
This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Nika Kanjani's brother has been in administrative segregation for the last 4 years. He has been in prison for almost 9. Nika visits him at least once a year, but the trip to West Texas from Montreal is not easy. Free World Pens is a documentary Nika made with images of Montreal and audio of her reading letters sent back and forth between her and her brother. The Prison Radio Show caught up with Nika to discuss her documentary.
My name is Nika Kanjani. I'm sitting here in my apartment with Candace, and I have my daughter Roxana sitting on my lap, and you can hear her probably chomping into an apple. This is the thing that will keep her busy and out of our way for a little while we have a conversation. I am a filmmaker and a writer, and I grew up in the United States, in Texas. I've lived in Montreal for the last 11 years. I came here for love, actually, and I stayed because I ended up going to film school and doing an MFA here. And anyway, it's become a home.
And last year, in 2014, you produced a 21-minute documentary titled Free World Pens. Maybe you could tell us, what is the movie Free World Pens about?
Oh boy. Well, I let's see. Why? The film is it's an essay film, and it's less of a it's not necessarily a documentary, but it is nonfiction. It's a document for sure, because back in 2006, my younger brother was very much to my family's surprise convicted of a felony in a trial that was really very, very shocking, because there was no evidence at all, and we were sure that nothing would come of it, but in fact he was sentenced to 14 years in a Texas penitentiary. And so I had already been living in Montreal. I'd just moved to Montreal like a year before, and I was down in Texas for the trial. And when it was over, I was in a state of shock, but I came back to Montreal, and I realized that in the subsequent years, I kind of unknowingly had been sort of obsessively collecting images and sounds and images of things like just the way the light came through the window and the way that the sounds outside my window were, like, you know, kids playing or church bells or cars passing or the radio, because I wanted to document all of the things that were informing my life in, like, sensually, you know, the sounds and the images and even, you know, the tastes. I wanted to record so that I could share with him someday, so he could know what was informing me and what was making me, what my days were like. And so the film became, it started out as a sketch many years ago, and then it turned into this project, a much more formalized project, that was based on many things. One was the letters that we wrote to each other
We wrote handwritten letters, and then I started then the technology changed, and I was able to send him electronic letters, but they would print them out, and he has to write letters by hand. So over the last 7-8 years, we've collected a lot of letters. And so this was sort of a document. I used some of the letters. So what's the film about? The film is it's a love letter. It's a love letter for me to Montreal, in a way, and it's also this love letter between my brother and me about our relationship, about... It's hard to say what it's about. It's really more affective and about feelings and... Yeah.
The narrative tends to be driven by these letters. Like, most of the audio consists of text from these letters, and I was wondering if you could maybe, for our listeners, tell us a little bit about the content of the letters, the tone, the content. Mm-hmm. What is he writing about?
Well, in these letters, he's usually answering questions that I'm asking him, and if you or your listeners know about writing to prisoners, and especially if they're in a place like in the U.S. and you're writing from Canada, it takes a long time. And for us, it was about 10 days to 2 weeks between the travel between our letters. So it changed the nature of our writing. We had to be a lot more deliberate about our questions to each other. And we had to... think about what would be still relevant to the other person in 2 weeks. So I was asking him questions like, what his days were like, and what things looked like around him, what the sounds were. I asked him to describe everything that he saw so that I could get a sense of what he was living through. Our lives had taken such incredibly different paths, and we're getting further and further apart. So I needed him to share with me what he was going through. So his letters were mostly about boredom and what he was doing to try to pass his time. His hope of the next appeal. We talked a lot about legal things, but then I also tried to ask him about, you know, what his sleep was like, what he dreamt about, what it was like to be. What was sleep like when you didn't have a sense of day or night, when you had no access to sunlight or a complete darkness, even because the lights were always on? And so it was mostly like the letters used in the film were about things of more of like the senses. Yeah.
Maybe you could tell us about the significance of the title, Free World Pens. What does it refer to? Where does the title come from?
Well, my brother was, and the film was really primarily about the years that he spent, 4 years in solitary confinement. We tried every 6 months, he was up for review, and every 6 months he would be denied, and for different reasons every single time. And it finally came out that the final thing, the one of the final things that they said to us, the reason behind his him being denied a move into general population, and was because of contraband that was found in his file many, many years ago. I asked them what the contraband was, and they said that it was that he had been found with 2 Free World pens and a bottle of Free World hand sanitizer. Mm-hmm. And so what Free World Pens refers to are pens that are not issued inside of prison. Somebody smuggled in pens, and he often would write about, and you could see in his letters, the pens would run out of ink, and he would describe like how frustrating it was to try to write letters when the pens were so shitty. And so getting access to some good pens was kind of a great thing, and it wasn't, you know, anyway. So that was, it was just the absurdity of that, of 2 pens that we could easily buy or even pick up off the street, being the reason that he would be held in solitary confinement. So, and it also, you know, it I think it's a nod to many things, including this desire to communicate with the outside world or the inside world, you know.
Visually, a lot of the shots are of places in Little Italy. Mm-hmm. And there aren't a lot of people in any of the shots. Mm-hmm. So I would say that like absence plays a big theme in the movie. And I'm wondering maybe if you could also speak to this notion of place, like how important is place in the movie for you, considering I feel like it's very grounded in Little Italy.
Well, I live in Little Italy, and I've lived here in this neighborhood for, I think it's going on 7 years. And, you know, it's part of my everyday quotidian life. I go to the same cafes, I walk the same alleyways. I used to have a dog, so I used to walk in alleyways a lot. And I used to work downtown, so I had this routine and this route that I had, and it was something I didn't even have to think about. It was just part of my landscape. And I think what the film, a lot of what it is about is disorientation. You know, living in one place and being physically grounded in a place, but having one's heart and mind and thoughts somewhere very, very different. In fact, somewhere you can't even imagine. I couldn't imagine. So I was relying on these letters to describe to me where he was, and that's where I was, even though physically I was here, and every day and every season I was going through the same neighborhood stuff, you know, just seeing the market and Cafe Italia and the alleyways and the hockey rink and the soccer fields and all of the places that people recognize. Yeah, it's sort of about that.
You mentioned that Free World Pens is partly a love letter to Montreal and to your brother, but for other viewers, like what would you hope that people take away from the movie?
Well, that's a really good question. I think my hope in making any of the work that I do is that I can create a little bit of a break, a little bit of a space in our sort of prescriptive lives for people to have like 15 minutes or 21 minutes, as the case may be with this film, to enter into their own, into this other sort of level, whether it's subconscious or just below the surface of the skin, you know. For me, what I feel like when I feel like my films and my projects are most successful when someone comes up to me and doesn't necessarily talk to me about my film or what it was about, but tells me where they went in their own mind while they were watching it, and you know, that they were remembering an old friend or a grandfather who was a survivor of something or something, you know, that just kind of occurred to them and hadn't for a long time but came up because they had this space to enter into some other zone. I mean, I think a pretty obvious thing would be to say that I hope that a viewer would see this film and get the sense that, you know, we see people walking around every day, holding it together, you know, being strong and being normal, and we don't necessarily know what's happening underneath. We don't know what struggles they have and what kind of suffering they're dealing with. And I think everybody has something, right? So this is sort of about, you know, living a life, doing what you do every day, going to work, going to school, paying your bills, getting through the snow, getting through the seasons, and then, but, you know, carrying something invisible all the time, every day. And I would hope that it's not about me. This film is like, I don't want people, believe me, it's very hard to make something that seems so confessional and that expose. I'm actually very private, so it's very hard for me to show this kind of thing. But it's, I feel like the project is actually successful in the sense that it's not so much about me or my brother. So it is rooted in something personal, but it's hopefully a lot more universal in the way that we can relate to people suffering and still holding that with some kind of grace and strength. And yeah, what I would hope is it just increases empathy. And yeah, that's probably the main thing.
It screened at the MAI, mm-hmm. Montréal Art Interculturel, a few months ago. It, otherwise, how can people access the documentary?
That's a good question. I really need to submit it. I've missed a bunch of deadlines. I think there's a couple of festivals here locally that I still can submit it to, so I don't have it available online for the public yet because it is still in circulation. But I'm hoping that maybe when it does get into a local festival, that maybe you guys could announce it so that people can see it at some point.
Well, Nika, thanks very much for your time. Do you have any final thoughts or comments you would like to share with the listeners of Prison Radio here on CKUT?
I mean, I think that if people are listening to Prison Radio on CKUT, they are already really keyed in to so many things that I don't need to explain or talk about. I mean, I can say that I never, ever imagined that, and I think my family didn't ever imagine, that we would be encountering the criminal justice system or prisons in any way that was personal. We never imagined it. It's been, I think anybody who has been involved with someone who's in prison or who has a loved one in prison, who's been in prison, knows what a nightmare it is. But strangely, and this is a much longer conversation, it has been a gift to be, to have a window into the experiences of so many people, because there's such a high number of incarcerated people in North America, and it seems to be growing. And I wish this was an issue that didn't exist, but it does, and I'm really glad that I'm a little bit more aware. Anyway, those that are listening, you know, keep encouraging people who are in prison. Keep writing letters, because I know that for my brother, for example, it's those letters that come in are his lifeline.
That was Nika Kanjani, who made the film Free World Pens.
Look alive.
time is presently 5:49. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. The song you just heard is by The Organ. It's called Brother. Up next is an excerpt from Tasha Fierce's essay, Sister Soldiers, that was originally published in Bitch Magazine's Law and Order issue.
Writer Tasha Fierce penned an article called Sister Soldiers, Black Women, Police Brutality, and the True Meaning of Black Liberation. Tasha herself is a Black feminist writer and Los Angeles native. Here, she reads an abridged version of her article. Let's listen.
This year, we've learned the names of men we should have never had to know. Eric Garner, a 43-year-old man who died in an NYPD chokehold while repeatedly saying, "I can't breathe." Michael Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old shot 6 times by police officer Darren Wilson. Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old shot and killed 2 seconds after police officer Timothy Lohman arrived at a Cleveland, Ohio park in response to a 911 call about a child waving a toy gun. Their names have become synonymous with police brutality against Black Americans, and their recent deaths have highlighted the pervasive racism within American law enforcement. A new Black liberation movement is in the process of formation, spurred by collective outrage over anti-Black police brutality. But what of Ayanna Stanley Jones, Yvette Smith, and Rakia Boyd? Unless you're looking for their names, you won't find their stories. All Black women, all under 30, shot and killed by police officers in the past 5 years, within the majority of discourse surrounding police reform. While media attention has focused on the tragic loss of Black cisgender men, it seems like we've forgotten that Black women are subjected to the same state-sponsored violence. Black women are also on the front lines of Black Lives Matter protests across the country. They're holding it down. They are daughters in spirit of Black women fighting in the Black liberation and feminist movements of the past, whose contributions have been minimized in the interest of maintaining the patriarchal, white supremacist status quo. The degradation of Black women's work and the sexual exploitation of their work dates back to slavery. It's an American tradition at this point. After slavery was outlawed, rape was used as a means of reminding quote-unquote uppity Black women of their place, just as lynching was used against Black men, though history rarely mentions this legacy of the Jim Crow era. The sexism and racism of larger society was reproduced in Black liberation movements, which limited the roles women were allowed to play. While Black men dominated leadership roles, Black women were expected to remain behind the scenes. When Black women activists were made national icons, it was in the stereotypical role ascribed to Black womanhood, stoic, long-suffering, motherly figures. Rosa Parks is popularly remembered as a humble, quiet seamstress who spontaneously decided to stand up to her oppressors. In fact, she was a fiery activist who was branch secretary in the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP. Parks, a victim of attempted rape herself, investigated sexual violence targeted at Black women as one of her duties as branch secretary. Yet Parks' legacy was sanitized in order to maintain her quote-unquote respectability as far as the attempted rape and to minimize her contributions to the movement that fell outside of her expected social role. Parks was somewhat complicit in the sanitization of her legacy to ensure the story of the civil rights movement and her involvement in it remained.